This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Here in eastern North Carolina, pre-Civil War, a thriving African-American community started churning into existence and a part of what we now know as New Bern. Dryboro had humble beginnings as only the second incorporated town in Craven County. By mid-century, it boasted many professional residents and its own hospital and library. After the Great Fire of New Bern in 1922, much of Dryboro was leveled. The community never made a true comeback, but it is making its mark on history with an expected designation as a National Historic District, part of downtown New Bern. Mac McKee has more today on Dryboro and why this historic African-American community may finally get the recognition it deserves.
On Wednesday, a public meeting facilitated discussion on the nomination process. New Bern City Planner and Historic Preservation Commission Administrator Kevin Robinson says the city's preservation plan gives priority status to Dryboro.
We've got four other historic districts here, and none of them tell the African-American side of the story in New Bern. And so that's very helpful, and it's very important that we recognize that.
Robinson says a State Historic Preservation Office grant of $15,000 was awarded in July for a survey of the area to determine more accurately the age of standing historic structures. The survey also lists the architectural details and historical significance of each building.
It would be preferable that Dryboro be its own standalone National Historic District. However, with its size and some of the features that have been lost, State Historic Preservation Office and others involved felt it would probably be better at this time to add it to the National District downtown. So this will be basically an annex to downtown, an extension of downtown.
Situated at the edge of New Bern, Dryboro was incorporated in 1806. Retired educator and native of New Bern, Ethel Martin Staten, grew up in the community. She's also the founder of the historic Dryboro Neighborhood Association.
A lot of people were coming in to live into the area to work on the train tracks and to work in the train depot and what have you, which was actually a growing thing at the time. And one of the reasons that New Bern eventually annexed Dryboro, due to the fact that she was losing her popularity and economic status to Fayetteville, Wilmington, and other places that were really where the trains were taken off.
Originally, the town was located north of Queen Street to Cypress Street and from West Street to Howard Street. The boundaries of the community grew as its popularity among African Americans gained steam. Staten says Dryboro was home to many prominent African American leaders, including John Thomas Barber, better known as J.T. Barber, who served as the first principal of West Street School. It was also home to the first African-American model for Pepsi-Cola, Loretta Smith.
I.H. Smith Sr. was one of the prominent persons, and of course he was very instrumental in developing houses into Dryboro, and the section that he developed became known as Smithtown.
Smithtown, along with the community of Dryboro, was devastated by the Great Fire of New Bern in 1922. City Planner Robinson says there are only a few original buildings still standing.
I believe that there are a couple churches that survived the fire. I believe two of them may have been moved, but they are the original structures. And I think at least two houses as well on the northern end of Dryboro that did manage to survive the fire. There's at least a handful of properties that predate the fire, and it's going to be really important to kind of document those.
The study, which will give more information on the history of Dryboro landmarks, will be completed in late spring. Robinson says they have until August to submit the surveys and nominations for National Historic Designation. It could be December before Dryboro makes its name in the National Register. If the designation is granted, Robinson says tax credits could help fund the restoration of what's left of historic structures in Dryboro. I'm Mac McKee.
It was billed as a once-in-a-decade opportunity, the chance to lure an international brand to relocate their worldwide headquarters to Charlotte. The pursuit of Chiquita was costly and controversial, and now, after only 3 years, Chiquita is already on the way out. The company announced this week it will close its Charlotte headquarters. So, was it worth it? WFAE's Tom Bullock examines the promises and the payoffs of the now-defunct deal.
To understand how this particular deal went down, we need to go back to September 12th of 2011. The unemployment rate here is at 8.8%. The front page of the Charlotte Observer reads, Bank of America to cut 30,000 jobs. Bob Morgan of the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce tells the city council, our leading corporate citizen is on the ropes. Bank of America may not exist in its present form in the next 12 to 18 months. The council is meeting in a closed-door session to approve a package of economic incentives that will bring Chiquita's headquarters and 400 jobs to Charlotte. Average salary, more than $100,000 plus benefits. The state estimates a net economic impact for North Carolina as a whole of more than $800 million over the next decade. But Chiquita has other suitors, so the council is asked to put together their side of an unprecedented incentive package right away. The company will get more than $21 million in state and local money over 11 years if they meet certain benchmarks. The first benchmark, jobs. Chiquita's incentives are largely tied to the number of employees at what would become its uptown headquarters. If the company creates 170 new jobs in 2012, Chiquita gets a check. 92 more the next year means another check, and so on. And Chiquita delivered on this promise in terms of numbers, and those people pay taxes, as does the company. Taxes were the second promise of this plan. These incentive deals only work if the company and its employees pay more money in taxes than the company receives in incentives. To date, Chiquita has received roughly $500,000 each from both Charlotte and Mecklenburg County in incentives. The state has ponied up another $1.5 million, which means Chiquita's 3 years in Charlotte cost $2.5 million in incentive cash. That's a steal, says Bob Morgan of the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce.
My back of the envelope calculation is, you're talking about a payroll over the last two and a half years in the tens of millions of dollars. You're talking about, I don't know the number of families, but probably approximately 100 families that have moved here from elsewhere. They are now part of our community.
Plus, there are so-called clawback provisions in the incentives, which allow the city, state, and county to get their money back if Chiquita breaks the deal. City and county leaders say Chiquita has agreed to repay the $2.5 million it received. The company has yet to comment. Then, there's the promise of longevity. Chiquita would stay in Charlotte for at least 10 years. We all know that one didn't work out so well. They were recently bought in a hostile takeover by two Brazilian firms. There's another promise, too, but this one is not found in the incentive deal or any transcript. The belief that, no matter what, Charlotte landing Chiquita would be good for the city. Bob Morgan puts it this way.
They help us tell the story. They've helped us sell Charlotte to Sealed Air and MetLife and to other companies that are going to bring good jobs to the community.
That view may be why Mayor Dan Clodfelter issued a statement saying, "We thank Chiquita for contributions to the community during their time in Charlotte." And why Mecklenburg County Manager Dina DiIorio issued talking points to county staff and commissioners. Here's one. We are appreciative of Chiquita's corporate philanthropy and investment in the community. But not every civic leader shares those warm feelings. Mayor Pro Tem Michael Barnes voted for the incentive package then. Today, he'd vote no because it failed to live up to its billing. And that, says Barnes, has consequences.
And what you will see is, we're trying to be, or at least I'm trying to be, as cautious about all the projects that we're considering, even things that we're doing, the Eastland project, the Bojangles project. We have to be more cautious about how we do those projects.
The city is working on a deal with a private company to turn Bojangles Coliseum into an amateur sports complex. The city would be responsible for half of the $70 million project. As for Eastland Mall, the city is still looking to lure a developer to that site. There's another potential cost, too, to Charlotte's reputation. All these incentive deals may lure companies, but, says Mecklenburg County Commissioner Bill James,
honestly, what kind of loyalty do you get? I don't want to sound crass, but, I mean, nobody falls in love with a hooker. And in essence, Mecklenburg County and the city of Charlotte, they've been hooking themselves out to these companies.
As for Chiquita, the company was taken private earlier this month. There is no word on where the new headquarters will be. And as for their roughly 300 Charlotte employees, they received a memo that stated, as a private company, there will be certain corporate services that are no longer necessary. I'm Tom Bullock in Charlotte.
Access to nutritious food remains a significant problem in the United States and around the world. Stop Hunger Now, an international hunger relief organization headquartered in Raleigh, is helping to change that. To date, the nonprofit has packaged almost 180 million simple nourishing meals that were distributed to 65 countries. Their goal is to assemble and deliver 2 million meals in 2015. On Monday, Peace Presbyterian Church in Winterville is teaming up with Stop Hunger Now and hosting a meal packing event. I spoke with program manager for Stop Hunger Now in Eastern North Carolina, Chris Singleton, who says they're still looking for people who'd like to help out.
Our mission is to end hunger in our lifetime, and we do that by meal that we put together through volunteers. We hope to do 2 million meals this year, so need a lot of other people that step up to the plate and volunteer as well.
Your goal is to pack more than 17,000 meals at this event in Winterville on Monday. How many volunteers will it take to accomplish that goal?
I think they're planning to have maybe 100 to 120. They can do that in about 2 hours, a little bit over.
Do you know how many volunteers have signed up so far?
I do not. I've not talked with them. We also have some from some other community groups and some from East Carolina as part of their Martin Luther King Day service.
Stop Hunger Now has worked with Peace Presbyterian Church at these packing events since 2010. So a lot of the people are probably familiar with how these packing events work. But for our listeners, can you describe the process?
Okay, we bring all the supplies and ingredients based upon what the church or organization has raised or donated. And we'll set up an assembly line. That assembly line will consist of funnel stations where the ingredients are put into a bag. Four or five volunteers at each station, and then we have some runners that will carry them to be weighed. We weigh them specifically for a special amount, and then they're sealed up at another station, and then they're boxed and weighed and packed on the truck.
That sounds like a lot of activity. Is there any kind of competition to see how quickly you can get the meals packaged?
We sound a gong at every time we package 1,000 meals. Competition usually kind of creeps into the process, but haste makes waste, and sometimes they might get a little bit too fast. But it's always a good, fast-paced, fun event.
So what do these prepared meals have in them?
They are composed of rice and dehydrated vegetables, a soy protein, and a vitamin supplement, super vitamin, really. And they've developed it especially for third world undernourished countries.
So the food that's packaged during these drives, where does it come from? Does it come from donations?
Yes. In this case, Peace has raised the money and some of the volunteers throughout the community. But we ask the churches or groups to raise the money. Some do it by fundraising. Some do it in their budget. But they raise the money, and then we bring the materials based on how much they've raised.
So how much is one package, one meal?
One meal is counted as one bag is counted as six meals, and it's 29 cents a meal.
And where does the food from Monday's event, where does that get sent?
We've shipped to 64 different countries, all what is considered third world or developing countries. Most of ours goes to schools and orphanages. We don't want to just give out meals. We want to try to keep kids in school and create some sustainable programs. We also work with organizations that already have established programs there. They have to prove themselves by certain criteria that they're putting the meals where they're supposed to be and using them the way that they're supposed to be used. We do follow up, even weighing children. I have some medical people that will go in and make sure the meals are being used properly and that the kids, that they are making a difference in kids' lives.
Well, it's a great organization. It sounds like a great event coming up on Monday. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. We're looking forward to it.
If you'd like more information on how you can help out, go to publicradioeast.org and click on ENC Events. Flu season may be starting to slow down after an early peak, according to state health officials. Whether it's coming down from its peak or not, it's advised you continue with flu prevention techniques. Get a vaccine, frequently wash your hands, and practice good everyday health habits like getting plenty of sleep and exercise. But if you do all that and the flu bug still bites,
commentator Joan Karras has a few suggestions on what to do once the misery sinks in.
A discussion about how to be sick may seem odd, but then again, everyone becomes ill occasionally. Knowing how to do it properly is bound to be useful. I know how because of the rich diversity of illnesses I've had in the last several years. Name a part of the human body and I have had a problem with it. Of course, we're not here to discuss my health problems, thank goodness, because we don't have all day. But let us consider how to improve the experience of being sick. Suppose you feel that you are coming down with a cold or the flu. Unless you want to share your germ with everyone at work, you'll need to call in sick. On the phone, speak in a weak and wobbly voice like this. Hi. I've been attacked by an evil virus. I can barely make it from my bed to the bathroom. It'd be a crime to expose any of you, so I need to stay home till it's safe for me to return. Okay, now you are officially sick. You will need chicken soup, plus the appropriate medicine and dependable help. Sick people belong in bed, so a sympathetic attendant is a must. In order to derive maximum help from your attendant, for heaven's sake, act sick. Forget all that noble, silent suffering nonsense. The many generations of females who have read Little Women, who all suffered with young Beth March as she died, quietly and sweetly, have been brainwashed into believing that patients should be patient and uncomplaining. In fiction, that's effective and heartrending. In real life, this attitude gets you nowhere. Remember the adage about the squeaky wheel? As you know, some scary illnesses are out there too, not just cold and flu. If you get one, quit lying around in bed supping on chicken soup. Fight back. Become a tiger. Read The Patient from Hell by Dr. Stephen H. Schneider. A recent cancer survivor as well as a physician, Dr. Schneider is on your side. He knows that savvy patients are the ones who survive, the ones who seek out the finest doctors and who know absolutely everything about their illnesses. Along with hundreds of helpful strategies, Dr. Schneider's constant admonition is persevere. While you're in tiger mode, soothe your soul with something also warm and furry, just a bit smaller. I recommend a warm, furry pet snuggled next to you. A cat or dog is best because the cat will purr and the dog will lick your face. Remember not to snuggle with a warm, furry hamster because human colds and viruses are typically fatal to hamsters. I'm blessed with two enormous felines, Bob and Alley Cat, who have done wonders for my health and disposition. In case you are petless, why don't you head on over to the nearest animal shelter so that when illness strikes, you'll be ready.
Joan Karras is a children's book author who lives in Beaufort. Her latest book is Magic at the Bed and Biscuit, published by Candlewick Press. You can hear this again by visiting the news section at publicradioeast.org. The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Crystal Coast Civic Center, Moorhead City, where every event is waterfront, business meetings and special event facilities available. Crystal Coast Civic Center, 252-247-3883. On February 3rd, NC Works Career Center is hosting a homeless and indigent veteran stand-down to reach out to veterans in need. This week I spoke with Disabled Veteran Outreach Specialist Kelly Hamilton about the free event.
From 10 to 2, a veteran would be able to come to the American Legion and get a whole host of services from food, shelter, health screening, VA benefits, referrals, and other necessary services that cover like health care, housing, employment, even substance abuse treatment. And what we do is we coordinate it with the VA and with the resources here in Onslow County.
How did the inspiration for this type of event come about?
About 5 years ago, my old supervisor, Larry Woods, he came up with the suggestion that we do one. You see them in bigger cities like in California, San Diego, and they're usually 3 days. And so we did the first one 5 years ago, and it was a good turnout. And each year it grows and grows and grows. So last year we had 43 resources out at the American Legion, and this year we'll probably have a little bit more.
How many veterans do you expect to attend this year's event?
I'm going to say 70 to 80 because the word is really getting out. And we've had other agencies to piggyback off of us that can assist us as far as like buying signs. And you guys are helping us too with the radio announcements. So just the word has to get out.
Could you put it into perspective for us how much of a problem homelessness among veterans is there in Jacksonville?
It's a big problem. What it is people don't see them because the homeless face has changed. You know, back in the day you saw them sleeping on the streets or pushing a cart. Anybody can be homeless if they're just couch surfing, if they're sleeping in their car, the whole nine yards. But we do have vets that come in here that are homeless, and we can refer them to the shelters.
Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
For more information on the Homeless Veteran Stand Down event, go to publicradioeast.org and click on ENC Events.
This is Lisa Rayburn, Horticulture Agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. I'm joined today by Christina Rigby. Christina's been an intern here at Cooperative Extension with us for the last 6 months, and she's been doing a great job. And Christina has some questions for me today.
Lisa, many people are cutting their crepe myrtle back hard right now. Do I need to do this to mine too?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of crepe myrtles being pruned back, just to the stem and bare wood? And the answer is probably not.
Doesn't cutting crepe myrtles back hard make them flower better?
People think that it does. It stimulates a flush of new growth on the plants. But actually, this sort of pruning that you typically see when you drive down the road actually results in a shorter bloom time, delayed flowering, weaker branches that are actually more susceptible to wind damage, and it can also increase insect and disease problems.
If what I'm seeing is wrong, what is the right way to prune a crepe myrtle?
The right way to prune a crepe myrtle is the same way that we want to prune most trees. We want to enhance the natural form of the plant and try to encourage it to have the best structure it can possibly have.
How can I determine if my crepe myrtle needs to be pruned?
The best thing to do is to sit down and look at your plant from a distance and then look at it up close. Is there any sort of dead or weak or damaged wood in the center of the plant? If that's the case, you want to go ahead and remove that first. The next thing you want to do is look for limbs that are crossing over on the interior of the plant. So each of the branches should branch up and out, but if there are branches that cross over the center of the plant or that rub up against each other, you're going to want to remove one of those branches.
Where is the right place to cut?
So you'll see that a lot of people just kind of cut somewhere, right? But plants actually, woody plants in particular, have a very defined place that they produce new growth to heal a pruning cut. And so for crepe myrtles or any other tree, you want to look at the base of the branch where it joins the trunk, and you're going to look and see that there's actually a little swollen ring that wraps around the base of that branch. You want to cut just outside that ring. That ring is called the branch collar, and it's where the plant is going to produce new growth to compartmentalize and seal over that wound.
Do I need to cut off all the old flower blossoms?
Some people do, but you really don't have to. Your plant is going to shed those blossoms in the spring as it pushes out new growth.
Why is the branch collar important?
Because that's where the plant is going to produce new growth that seals over that pruning cut.
What if I need to cut an entire branch or trunk out?
If you need to cut an entire branch or trunk out, you're going to cut it either on the branch just external to the collar or on the trunk. You're going to take it off as close to the ground as you cleanly can. If you have to take a trunk out, realize that crepe myrtles will send up those sprouts from the trunk, so do it only as a last resort. And if you do, come in early summer and rub those new shoots off as they're coming up. Because if you cut them and then they sprout up again, you'll just be fighting them over and over. Thank you, Christina, for joining us today. And for our listeners, please go forth and prune your crepe myrtles thoughtfully and carefully and set a good example for crepe myrtle care in your neighborhood.
Public Radio East is seeking an experienced part-time reporter to help contribute to the Downeast Journal. If you're interested, send us a sample of your work to Public Radio East, Attention Downeast Journal, 800 College Court, New Bern, NC, 28562. Include your resume, cover letter, and a sample of your work. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions for topics you'd like to hear explored on the Downeast Journal. You can contact us at publicradioeast.org.